I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good evening and welcome to
Foment About It
on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izett.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And I'm Rachel Jacobs.
And we're your co-hosts through this weekly journey of all things fermented.
Archived on Stitcher, iTunes, and right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Future Us just did that. We just said hello to the show. That was, Future Us knows exactly what's going on. Let me tell you about today. This is yester me talking. This is yester Chris. I've been getting up really early last week, getting all sorts of things going on at Fifth Hammer. We got a compressor to the roof at 5 a.m. We've been getting up at 7 a.m., getting the cold box together, and things are really freaking excited. So this is yester me in real time.
Anyway. Okay, and now we're going to go for real. All right, we're here in the studio with Ken Fornitero of Cultures Group. Welcome, Ken.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. And how are you?
So I think we met you actually through the Ferment Meetup and then at Ferment.
First, yep.
Yeah.
And then
something at Brooklyn Fermentation Festival, too.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. And I finally got to taste some of your ferments there.
Good. Did you debut my honeydew sake?
Yes. And I had the beef broth.
Beef broth.
Oh, the beef sake. That was
yes,
great.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Let's dive right into that. Why not?
That was
wild. Because we brought it up. What is beef broth sake?
Well, you know what sake is. It's like a dual fermentative process liquid, really, that depends on both yeast from what's called the maromi and also koji, which is Aspergillus oryzae. Inoculated rice. If you're doing some other kind of drink like shochu, you might use a different type of grain or even like sweet potatoes. But with sake, it's always rice, right? and so there's a long history about, you know, how did sake actually evolve? How did miso evolve? You know, what is something called hishio, which seems to be like several thousand years old, and basically how it all seemed to evolve was that somehow someone figured it out, and why they figured this out is just one of those mysteries that, like, we're really glad they did.
Yeah.
Somehow some rice got inoculated with a mold, an aspergillus that's benign, and actually turns out to be the oryzae and probably like 12 different types of aspergillus are really very, very useful commercially and for creating what we call transformative processes, which is actually what our organization is all about. And I'll talk about that a little later. When the whole thing first started, what happened was they realized that the enzymatic activities from this rice were able to do amazing things to all different kinds of foods. And so originally, I think before sake was actually invented, I think what it was that they would like throw something that they had a lot of into this like environment where there was this rice inoculating. And they realized that you could make if you let the process go out far enough, you could actually make alcohol, which is what they really wanted to do. So eventually, somewhere down the line, they decided they would split the processes up and say, okay, we're only going to make this drinking sake with, like, rice. Then we're going to, like, make this stuff called hisho, which eventually turned into miso. If you wanted to use what was on hand, usually, which is typically how most things are really invented out of necessity, right? And you would make shoyu, which is like basically the soy sauce part of it. So one of the things we always do, too, is try and see if we can, like, go back and recreate a specific situation where, okay, why did somebody decide all of a sudden that they wanted to, like, separate out making sake from preserving beef or preserving fish, mm-hmm. for example? Fish misos and fish sakes are probably more common than you would ever know about. But
really?
You know, yeah, you're not going to see you're not going to see much fish sake out there. But
right.
what you will see, although unfortunately, like most of these real old time traditional things that were happening, like some people, some Japanese people, for example, who are remember like in the Akita Prefecture, for example, when specific times when there was a lot of lightning out, right, in the early, so like in April, the next day, everyone would go to either the ocean or people would come around and these vendors would have huge buckets of a certain kind of fish, right,
mm-hmm.
because they all like knew that they could get incredibly inexpensive. A fish, because they all—I think they all kind of got killed by this lightning, and that was really the first time that the whole concept of, like, I think fish sauce that they kind of knew how to make, but that kind of like came about from that.
Because they had sounds like because they had excess.
Yeah, I mean that's
sure.
the whole concept of anything that. You preserve or you ferment, I think really is not only to apply the whole transformative process to it, which create. I mean, the transformative process itself, almost out of necessity, is used not just to ferment something, but to actually transform the actual product to make it last so you can survive. I mean, there are times when... any culture, I think, has severe starvation, basically, because something happens in the environment that they're not able to control. And I think that when people started to realize that you could preserve something and you could actually alter that transformative process in some way to your benefit, I think that's when people said, okay, let's start doing this on a regular basis. So they had all these things, and people were like, okay, what can we do with this excess that can be spectacular, not just for survival purposes, but for really enjoying, like, something great?
Right.
And that was when all these great sake houses, for example, came to be, and they very closely guarded their secret of, like, what they were doing.
Right.
So one of the things that you wouldn't do at that point would be to, like, make fish sake or to make beef sake. It would be
right.
like, man, why would you do that, right? They had to figure out something to do with things like soybeans or millet or wheat, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when it really, the brilliance of what people decided to do really took off. So when we made our beef sake or our honeydew sake, what we thought we would do is, like, okay, let's go back and see what we can push the limits on and see how this will taste. And it's really no different than saying, say, you know, if you use the enzymes that are naturally present in something, you can create amazing things. And, you know, nowadays, like, there's this concept that if you're having sake during a meal, you're not going to eat rice as well, right? To me, it kind of, like, parallels what happened, like... when this huge wave of, like, Italian immigrants came to the United States, like, maybe 100 years ago, maybe 150 years ago, and they were primarily from Sicily, right? And they decided to create a cuisine that Americans would like. So at that point, it seemed like everything Italian food was like really, really heavy on the garlic and really heavy on the oregano, for example. And that was like what Italian food was, when in fact, if you were actually from Italy, like, you would never see that kind of food. And I think the same thing happened with Japanese food and Japanese sake, where things like kind of like really low-grade, inexpensive, hot sake was like the sake that was available anywhere. And it's just, if you went to Japan, you're going to find like some really like, you know, the fast food type of places that they have in Japan, unfortunately, more and more of nowadays. You're going to find things like hot sake, but real Japanese food, and you know, which is just really one of the most brilliant cuisines ever invented. You would not even think of serving sake hot. I mean, yeah. It's like, you know, that typically that denotes an inferior grade sake where they put this stuff, brewer's alcohol, basically. Or, right.
So let's talk about the, do you mind talking about your beef broth sake process?
If you want. I mean, I think it's more like a...
Instead, in lieu of water, you use...
Yeah, beef, I use beef broth, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And you would do the same thing with the
You could do that with a lot of different things. Like with the honeydew sake that I made, I mean, besides actually, this one was a little more planned than the beef broth one, where we actually took like something that we knew would collect the yeasts from the honeydew. So we actually went into a field of honeydew melons with it and collected the yeast from there, right? Which is kind of a hard thing to do nowadays. Like if you're making sake, I think there are like 14 yeasts or something that are really like, that are so well controlled by the sake brewers, like whatever it is. In fact, the entire manufacturing of sake in Japan is really heavily and tightly controlled, where like you're not even allowed to, it's against the law. And they're actually strict about it, too, where you can't make something like Dobaruku, which is like this farm-style sake, which is, it's kind of like a rice beer that doesn't go through as many refinement processes. You're not going to see any fining of, like, you know, whatever. It's like a Nigori sake, right, but it's still with the mash, et cetera.
It says illegal, though, because it's so
raw?
Yeah,
it's illegal. And also, that's how you could, because... every time you add something to a Maromi or like starting from the Shubo of the whole thing, you're going to create more alcohol. Like every time you add additional rice to something, and your yeast is, you know, really active and going and wild enough, which everyone has access to, right? If, regardless of whether you have an official sake yeast, you can get the yeast, right?
Right.
Which is really why we decided that we would do that and say, okay, what would happen if, you know, this, we took some beef broth, which is would not be completely uncommon, or fish broth for that matter, right? And we took our own yeast and said, okay, let's just start dumping some inoculated rice in there, some koji, and see what happens. And we kept doing that, and we actually refined it. We strained it. We did the whole, like, you know.
So I did not get to taste it, as I was saying. Yeah. Can you give me some kind of flavor notes on what it was like,
if more.
It was compared to it?
It kind of tastes like a beef
It was very rich and earthy. It tasted like beef broth, but it had... I mean, it didn't taste harsher by any means. It's very smooth, and it's like drinking a slightly alcoholic beef broth.
Yeah.
Do you now want to add sake to your beef and barley soup, Mary?
No. I don't think you... It's not
would
like that, because this tasted very... I mean, it tasted like a really good broth that had more dimensions, I think. Yeah.
It sounds... Yeah. I mean...
That's a whole... It's like... It's layering the umami of something.
Right.
Yeah.
Really.
So have you done it with the fish, with fish broth?
We have
yet?
One going right now.
Yeah. You have one going right now. Right.
We also have a lot of different fish misos and fish hishios going right now. It's kind of been funny. We've been like heavily lobbying this really, really incredible fish market. Like, this is two blocks away from where I live. Like, every day we see them throw out, like, just tons and tons and tons of things like fish guts and heads, et cetera. And we're like, no, don't do that. Please give them to us, right? And like, we can't do that. Like, and it's like, why not? And technically, nowadays, I mean, everyone's always worried about liability, right?
Right.
And so if, for example, and I know this because, one, I've been a chef and working in the food industry for like 40 years now, and I know, like, you know.
I'd like to dive into that.
There's nothing more interesting to an owner of a food business is than liability and not getting sued, all right? I mean, that's really an important thing. So basically, if, for example, they gave us these things because of the way they particularly maintain hygiene levels at their store, if, for example, there was any bleach or ammonia or anything that got on there, we could end up really, like, hurting people really badly and then sue them for it, you know what I mean? Require that their employees specifically treat something in a specific way that they're not paid to do. You know what I mean? Like, you can't even get bones out of these people when you go in and buy fish. Like, they'll do whatever you want to the fish, but they're not going to give you the bones. Yep. And the reason why they won't give you the bones nowadays is the same. It's the liability issue. It's like, no, we don't want your kids choking on bones, and we don't want you choking on bones because you're coming back and sue us, right?
Right.
And that's what that's about.
Crazy culture.
So, so we're going to take a brief break, and we will be right back with more Fascinating Ferments with Ken Fornitero.
Heritage Foods USA is a farm-to-table online butcher and founding sponsor of Heritage Radio Network.
Heritage Foods got its start when Patrick Martin's first stepped foot onto Frank Reese's Kansas farm in 2001. Back then, Frank was the only farmer in America raising true heritage turkeys with recorded lineages tracing back more than 150 years.
Patrick knew instantly he'd found a unique moment, an opportunity to go beyond acknowledging these breeds as being jeopardized and to actually do something to save them. Patrick asked Frank to ramp up production and made a promise to him that if he would raise them, Heritage Foods USA would sell them.
That was the moment that Heritage Foods' slogan, Eat 'em to Save 'em, was born. By creating a market for delicious meats from heritage breeds, we can ensure they'll be around for generations to come.
Plus, heritage breeds just taste a whole lot better. Learn more at heritagefoodsusa.com and use the code HERITAGERADIO for 2 free pork chops with your first order, brother.
And we're back. Welcome back to Ferment About It. We're in the studio with Ken Fornitero.
Okay.
So you said, what is it called? Hashi?
Hishio.
How do you spell that?
H-I-S-H-I-O, yeah.
Okay. And what is the difference? What is it exactly? Because I know I've heard of it and I think I've had it, but it's a relative of miso and all of these other ferments. But what is the
I think it was actually the original miso that eventually, I mean, basically starting out, and I think you could linguistically, if you went back and look at like the actual kanji that's used to designate, et cetera, it started off like just about everything in food seems to have started off in China, right? I mean, they would call it zhang, the stuff that you would make from fermenting a certain thing. There's different kinds of applications, different kinds of like koji, and there's like so many different kinds of koji itself. For most of Asia, you would use what's primarily called a mochi koji, which is not just aspergillus oryzae. It's got like mucor. It's got like it's more inclined to have something that you could actually create tempeh with, like right? There's rhizopus, etc. So primarily before miso was like segregated out, they would take like huge barrels of whatever it is. Originally, it was just soybeans, really, that they would inoculate somehow, usually with the oryzae. In Japan, it was the aspergillus oryzae. In other cultures, the Koreans, the Chinese, etc., they would create more like dung. They would create their different types of material that they would use different substrates. Right? But in Japan, it was primarily soybeans. And when it was determined that soybeans made a really, really heavy, dense soy sauce, they would then, they decided, okay, why don't we, like, cut it with some wheat, right? Or I think, actually, although I'm having a hard time actually validating, I think primarily they use millet, though. And but if you were doing this at home, which is what we're actually trying to encourage people to do, you would, you know, I think it's easier to make hisho first before you get into miso, although, you know, I don't know. It might be easier to make miso because now you can access, like, already pre-inoculated rice pretty easily. I mean, right. If you're really desperate for some, just call us or email us. We'll send you some, right? Because we're not into, like, that part of, like, selling that stuff yet. We're more into, like, getting you to understand what the process is hopefully getting some kind of sponsorship from people who will, like, want us to teach you the process as opposed to sell you whatever the product is.
Right.
Right.
So that's, I think, our difference between...
Right, so let's circle back about that.
Sure.
So what exactly... How did you get into fermentation? What is your relationship with that? And what exactly is Cultures Group and the goals?
Yeah, who is us?
We're within. Yeah.
Exactly.
Who is us? The Royal
Weed. I have a really wild history with fermentation and cultures, etc. Both of my grandmothers are ridiculously skilled fermenters, gardeners, hunters, food creators. I mean, they're really just astonishing. And in both cases, one grandmother came from... basically, when she was a child, she grew up in the Swiss mountains, very, very near a lot of Italian influences as well. So by the time I was like 5 years old, my father, who was started off as an incredible baker, was making like sourdough breads, just like both my grandmothers and my father insisted that I just like hang out with them, and I loved it. I really did. So when I was 5 years old, I just started, like, you know, hanging out in bakeries with my father and going to the fields with both my grandmothers and, like, collecting stuff. And my grandmother, the Italian one, had this amazing root cellar, which if you were, like, a five-year-old kid, you would think, oh, my God, this is the coolest place ever, right? And it was. And it took me a while to figure out exactly what was going on down there, but... She used to make this tomato sauce that was, like, famous everywhere as far as I had known because people would, like, beg her for some of this stuff. And what she was doing, she was making this tomato sauce with a lot of different really sweet herbs and spices, and she was putting it down at, like, maybe this 45, 50-degree Fahrenheit temperature and just basically letting it lacto-ferment for, like, 6 or 7 months a year. So she would always have it, yeah. And I'm like... It took me a while to figure out why is this so incredibly sweet, and like the depth of it was amazing, right?
Yeah.
And so she finally decided, okay, she was going to let me into all this stuff. I may be like 12 years old, and that was when also this neighbor of mine, and she brought me back this thing, which is... it was kind of like a little book. It kind of looked like a silk wallet, right? And I'm like, what is this thing? And there's really gorgeous paper inside. I said, what is this used for, right? And I thought about it for days and days. And finally I said, what is this, right? To her, she says, well, in Japan, if you ever go out, you know, you always have something inside of your kimono, right? You always carry one of these around in case you have to use the bathroom. And what that was actually toilet paper, but... You know, it was like the Japanese way of doing something. It was just so elegant, so chic, you know. About, mm-hmm. So this is great. So, and just about that time as well, my sister, older sister who was going to college in Boston, decided that she would bring me home because she knew I loved bread baking at that point. Sure. She brought me back a copy of the Tassajara bread book, right? And I'm like, oh, my God, right? This is an amazing book. And that was how I realized, like two or three years later, when I went to college really early, actually, I went to visit her a lot in Boston when I was going to Brown University, right? And when I was 19 years old, I decided, okay, you know what? I really, really, really want to be a chef because I already knew so much. So I walked into this place called L'Hermitage, which was probably about 100 feet away from this store that had just opened called Erewhon, right? And who should be hanging out at Erewhon but people like William Shirtleaf and Akiko Ayago and Michio Kushi and Aveline Kushi, okay? And I just kind of, like, went there every day and, like, really made friends with everyone there. I actually made my first miso there with Bill. I mean, this was, like, the most amazing place in the world. Yeah. Within 2 months, they made me the executive chef of this place. And the entire cuisine, I had been studying, but this place called the Hermitage was really... had such an incredible lasting impression on me as far as fermentation went. One, because it was all about food using basically Russian ingredients, either wild or wet, and applying French principles. And while I was there, I mean, you know, something like tekmali sauce, for example, which is like umeboshi plums. You'd say, why are the Russians using umeboshi plums? They would, the Georgians would marinate these chickens in like garlic and wine, oranges, etc., and really like grill them until they were like very brown, and then serve them with this fermented umeboshi plum paste that we would also put coriander, fresh coriander in. I mean, it was like,
it sounds awesome.
It was amazing. Yeah. It really was.
Like the right combo.
That's going to be in what we're currently writing 3 books. That's hopefully going to be in one of the books on Russian ferments. But the part where the fermentation part really exposed as well is like when I was executive chef for the Hermitage, we were lucky enough to have, I don't know if you know much about the Boston area at that time, but like in certain places where there was a huge influx of either Russian Jews coming in, like in Allston or Brookline, etc. I mean, I met like Barney Frank, for example. I met when I was 19 years old in Brookline, for example, and because he got him to actually come and talk at Brown. But all these like women would come and work for me. And I remember talking to Sandra Katz about this once, about like, because he asked me once, where did you learn this stuff? Like, these women would come, and it took me a while to figure out exactly what they were doing. Like, we on our menu, we had a lot of different fermented things. Like, we would make these buckwheat pancakes, blini, basically. And I was always like, I would always buy yeast, right? And they just never wanted to use it. I'm like, why, how? I don't understand why you're doing this. But every time I'd come in, someone would be taking something out of, like, her pocket or, like, you know, and putting it into the stuff. And, like, 2 or 3 hours later, we had this explosively rising, like, buckwheat batter. I was like, how are you doing this, yeah. Right? And so finally I realized that basically they were using the same yeast that they had somehow smuggled in with them from wherever they were coming from, basically in Eastern Europe. I mean, and so that was when I decided, okay, tell me everything you know about, like, why are you doing this, like, fermentation-wise? Mm-hmm. And they would show me the most amazing ways to, like, preserve or ferment everything from vegetables to meat to fish, etc., and especially mushrooms, too, which I think one of the most unknown things about Russian cuisine, for example, is that Their use of mushrooms and their fermentation of mushrooms and the growth of mushrooms, wild gathering of mushrooms, is incredible. It's intense. I mean, they've been doing this for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And it's just not something that... it's
not talked about or celebrated.
Yeah, isn't it wild? Right? Yeah. But yeah, it's just one of the amazing things. But yeah, the Russians have a very long history. It's not just about kvass or, you know, the beach, like, you know, the float ski wash or whatever, right? Yeah. It's really a pretty extensive, almost like a hunter-gatherer type of thing where they would... They were usually amazing hunters. They knew exactly where, like, certain mushrooms grew, where certain wild plants, etc. Yeah. And a long time, I think the popularity of, like, the whole samovar culture there and their teas depended a lot on what wild roots and herbs they were actually able to grow. There was that part, and then there was the whole thing with I decided to become really involved with Japanese food. Through Bill and Akiko and went like to that whole like Berkshire's area where there were like there were the first like pop up restaurant type things where when the weather was good they would just go and they would just like start making food. That's where I like discovered what perilla was, and we used to make tons and tons of miso and like shoyu and hisho, which. I think if I were to explain hisho, it's more like, okay, if you're going to make miso, for example, you're going to need, like, some kind of beans, right, or legumes. Or you could use some other, you know, you can inoculate just about anything with kojin as long as there's carbohydrates there. It's all about the scarification and you know, basically you want to break things down into simple sugars. With miso, depending on what kind of kojin you make, and this is why it's really important, on what you're using to make your koji with and what kind of spores you use. Right. Because you want to make koji that can break down, that's going to create proteases and lipases and not just amylases, which is what you would do if you're going to make...
beer.
You know, like beer or sake or whatever it is, right? So hisho, I would think, is you would want to make koji and put it in an environment where if you had any leftover beef, if you had any leftover fish, anything like that... and you would throw it in there with soybean center, it'd probably be twice as much liquid as a miso would have. I think actually, at a certain point, the whole concept of tamari, the stuff that comes off of miso, I think that originally, when they first started making it, when it was a higher volume of liquid to whatever it was, I think that was the original hisho.
Hisho. Yeah.
And then whatever the maromi part of it was, which is like, you know, whatever you would like strain out. If you were doing it with legumes or beef or whatever you were doing it with, or fish, that would eventually become the miso part.
So like Chris and Whey, but with...
Yeah. And with soy sauce, the same thing. I think, you know, that was just another part of that entire family of things. It's really, I think it's a liquid content thing, which is why... Interestingly, and here's another thing that people have, I think, kind of like not as much picked up on in miso is that misos with like dried vegetables, for example, like daikon, etc. There's a whole, it gets to a point where there's very little separation between what skimono or pickled vegetables are, which you can use a lot of different things to pickle, and actual miso. Like, if you were making miso in the countryside, you would make sure you had it layered with vegetables as well.
Right.
So during the period, like, you'd take out, like, your half-dried daikon, et cetera, and eat it, and you'd say, wow, this is an amazing thing, right? So.
Now, yeah, because we're running out of time, and we have to talk about culture.
We still got to talk about the weed.
Yeah, so you spent 40 years in the food industry as a chef. So what made you go and start Cultures Group, and what is Cultures Group?
And how can people find out about it?
Our organization, Cultures Group, is based on Wu Tsing, which is like basically five-element Chinese medicine and acupuncture.
Wu Tsing?
Wu Tsing, yeah.
Wu Tsing.
Wu Tsing. And it's all about, the five elements of water, wood, fire, earth, and metal, right? And everything in life... including eating food and enjoying food and what happens in your microbiome. It's all about transformative processes and how each of these elements interact. So so why did we decide to create Cultures Group, and who are we? We're primarily, I have a background in microbiology, right? And I had like a 20-year period during which I said, basically I was dragged from the kitchens of of Bloomingdale's, where they knew I was like basically dragged out in like 1980 and said, listen, we have this serious, serious crisis going on in the community, and it's called AIDS, and we need you to come and work doing something to help us do this. So I went, I became the deputy director of this place called Community Research Initiative, hung out with all these people at AMFAR, we just signed up for conferences, got very, very heavily involved with like ACT UP. I helped to co-found the Treatment Data Committee. Basically, what we did during that 20-year period was change the entire drug approval process, created actual effective therapies for HIV and AIDS, really created, I think, what is the most powerful and successful community-based movement ever in the history of the United States. And that's actually how, when people ask me how I know Sandra Katz, for example, Sandra and I were arrested, like, together trying to take over the FDA, right? He was in an affinity group that, so that's how I know Sandra. And so I spent, like, I took, like, a 20-year hiatus to do that. And it was really, you know, because it was desperately needed. I mean, if you saw what was happening to every kitchen that I'd ever been in, if you saw what was happening to the food industry at that point, not to mention the world itself, I mean, it was unbelievable. And you'd, like, you know, you could go into a kitchen, and all of a sudden you'd see somebody who was really, really sick. Yeah. And then 2 weeks later, they would not be there anymore. It's like, what happened to this person? Yeah. I was living on the Lower East Side at the time, and, like, at first, you'd walk down the street, and you'd see, like, entire houses that were blocked off with this police tape, right? Because someone had died of AIDS, like, and sometimes it was someone you had talked to, like, a few days earlier. It was, like, just unbelievable what's going on. So I said, all right, you know, the world can wait for my cooking skill, right? Yeah. I need to do this. And so, I mean, during that period of time, I wrote probably about 100 different research protocols for some specific drugs that turned out to be really effective treatments. Yeah, we created this thing called Parallel Track. We created this. We sped up the drug approval process. Like, we took like 10 years off of everything at least. We demanded and got the ability to, because back then, in research, as in society, I mean, the concept of allowing a woman, for example, or someone who was not really, like, well-insured or wealthy to participate in a research study, which at that point was the only way you were going to get any treatments for HIV, they just would not hear of it. People did not want to move on a lot of different things. The racism was just unreal. Yeah. The first study from the AIDS Clinical Trial Group, for example, from the National Institutes of Health, the average participant, like 89% of the people in their first trial, were white men with PhDs. Okay, I mean, it's astonishing.
Not representative,
right,
of the overall population.
Yeah, at all. So, I mean, we had to push and push and push and push really hard for a long period of time. And I think really the most unfortunate thing is that just like in the last, I don't know, like 10 years, maybe 5 even, it's like we're back to square one again with that. It's not a little disappointing. It's really awful, right? Yeah. So, but yeah, so basically what we decided, why we decided to create Cultures Group. So according to the Wu-Tsang, or five-element theory, there are 5 different ways that you can approach food, you can approach life, you can approach transformative processes, et cetera. And so our 5 points are that, most of all, like, you have to metabolize food to live. I mean, it's a survival thing, right? So, and unfortunately, still today in this world, people don't have equal access at all to the same resources as other people. And sometimes you really need to use extra, like, knowledge that once used to be common commonly passed down from generation to generation, that because of the way food is produced nowadays and it's been so hugely corporatized, people don't really...
People are happy to be unaware of what they're eating. Something
Well, the tradition's been broken. Yeah. Like, that line has been broken. Yeah.
That's a really awful thing. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that we want to get people back into understanding through the books we write, through the posts and things that we talk about, is that the most basic transformative process that you as a human being can do is to metabolize food, right? And in order to metabolize food, you need to know what a microbiome is. You need to know why it can go wrong, too. So that's where we like try and emphasize microbiology and the microbiome stuff and how you can actually do things like create your own probiotics and prebiotics to be able to better transform stuff. Always with the understanding that, listen, one of the greatest pleasures in life is eating food. And we have the same attitude towards alcohol, too. It's like, you know, these things are really wonderful things that, you know, you should be able to know individually what you can and cannot tolerate or what you do or don't want to do. And the further your distance from how something is actually made, the more difficult it is to actually understand that. Yep. And we're convinced that most chronic illnesses somehow have a link to breaking that tradition. You can really create yourself a much better functioning system if you know what you're eating, what you're putting in stuff. So we emphasize things like nutrition, microbiome. We're also very, very, very interested in the whole process of aging and particularly dysphagia as well. You know, I mean, if you go and look at like cohorts of people with like Parkinson's or Alzheimer's or, you know, any other chronic illness, you're going to see that like 89-90% of them can't eat, right? And they're basically starving to death. And we have all these chefs out there, right? We have all these artisans out there who know how to do these things to help people, right? If they just learn how to do it. So we really want to like stress to them, okay, listen, it's wonderful you have all these skills in making these fabulous types of foods, etc. You should always think about why you're doing this in the first place, right? All right? Why are you doing this as a chef other than to like make money, okay? Because, you know, in this world you have to make money usually, right? But we think that it's really important just as part of the whole karmic existence in life that... you should always be giving back, because we've all really been blessed with these incredible gifts from nature, and how we treat them is just, it's really kind of awful what we're doing when we could really be helping not only ourselves but each other.
Yeah.
Even more. I mean, we've got all these people out there who are very talented who would say, okay, I'm going to like lacto ferment something that's loaded with prebiotics, and using the skills that I've learned from understanding what transformative processes I can direct through the use of yeasts and like molds and enzymes that I can create as an artisan or as a chef, I can make something that's already broken down into this really rich, accessible food, and we can make sure anyone can eat it, anyone can have access to it based on whether or not, you know, they can't really swallow things anymore. I mean, you know, how hard is it to strain something, right? And the entire general population, like 1 in 5 of them, is currently suffering from dysphagia, right? That's 1 in 5 is an astonishing number, yeah. Right? And if I didn't, like, one of the things I do on a regular basis is go up to the ENT clinic at Mount Sinai, for example, mm-hmm. where in the last 5 years alone, you know, people who used to suffer from mouth or tongue or throat or cancers from HPV, now, in the last 5 years, we've seen like 1,000% increases in the number of people who are actually not only dying, but suffering from everything from dysphagia to the need to have huge portions of their body cut out because of cancers.
Yep.
So that's another reason why we think it's really, really important that we apply what we know about these transformative processes, that we know about probiotics and prebiotics and creating good food, to make them available, because maybe that'll also draw people out, because dysphagia is one of the things that no one ever really talks about.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. So it's great that it's on, and there's information on culturesgroup.net.
Yeah.
As well as the Facebook group.
You can go to culturesgroup.net, first of all.
Okay.
Online. You can just hit anything that has at culturesgroup with it, like on Twitter, on Pinterest even. Actually, Facebook, you can find us at Aspergillus or Culture Group or Koji. One of those three things. Yeah.
Now, if people are more interested, do you have some place that they could get more information, or if they want to become more involved in the project? What is the best way?
We would love them to become more involved. I mean, we're currently trying to put together three different books, and one of them is called Swallow, actually.
Cool.
Swallow the Book, and it's all about we're encouraging people to think about, like, and most of the people, like my age, for example, have parents who are or like probably undergoing one or, you know, some having difficulties with dysphagia, for example, or suffering from a specific illness, and we really want to write this one book so that people can use this information to make it easy to provide them with, like, nutritious food that doesn't come from a can, because I don't know if you know about that canned stuff, but it's usually like
a little bit of sugar,
fructose,
also.
Oil,
yeah,
and like whatever it is, and so many vitamins. That the also the thing too that we really want to emphasize is that we want people to have fun. We want people to enjoy themselves, because there's nothing you can do to stop the transformative process of life, right?
Right.
And the idea is to, like, enjoy it as much as you can. And if there's any way that we can help people to access tools to do that better, that's what we're all about, right? I mean, everyone who's involved with us is either a chef, right, or who knows how to do something specifically, because they were taught by their, like, grandparents, for example, right? And we really want to be like more like a clearinghouse center where people can get information as well as inspiration. They can share with each other, and they can use what they know to be activists for themselves and for other people as well.
Because, their friends, their family, their community.
You know, the whole industrialization of the food that we're creating in this country is really not a good thing. We want people to get back into the whole, like, we want people to know how to support a family farmer, for example, or
right.
a family farm, or somebody who's doing something small as opposed to huge, because usually the people who are doing something small are not going to be requiring, you know, chemicals to do what they're doing, right? So, So, I mean, we need lawyers, we need writers, we need researchers, we need microbiologists, we need people who just, like, really want to do things like, you know, work on educating each other. I mean, we need writers, we need experimenters.
So how do they contact you if they want to get more involved?
Yeah, just culturesgroup@earthlink.net.
Okay, perfect.
Or they can, the other thing they can do also is, like, if you go to culturesgroup.net and follow us, we'll have your info.
Mm-hmm. And then you have an email list as well, or are developing one. Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for
being
on.
Awesome.
Yeah, and and we'll continue. We'd love to follow you through the journey, so we will definitely be back in touch with you at some point. Thanks to all of you who are listening out there, and we'll be back next week on The Men About It.
Thanks, Jen.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you save a little room for dessert.